this interest in what was, after all, outside of the strict realm of English literature, namely advertising, brought him into contact with a remarkable figure at the University of Toronto, Harold Innes. Now, Harold Innes was an economic historian, and he had written two books that had a tremendous impact upon Marshall McLuhan. One was called Empire and Communications, and the other was called The Bias of Communication. And the thesis of that Innes presented was that a major change in technology, particularly a major change in the technology of communication, has a transforming and possibly revolutionary effect upon society, quite independently of the desire of anyone in that society to change, that it actually can cause convulsions in nations when it occurs. And he mentioned as example number one the invention of the printing press by Johann Gutenberg, and to this he attributed everything from compartmentalization in business.
Slicer dicers that grow in the dark, rubber roads that lead nowhere, gas bags zizzing tanned, happy people to work anywhere in the world. Digital beds, watches that won't melt, in hotels, ant-proof casters, lights that never go out. A cure for the shuffles, cheap art and compulsive education, and all of this by 61. The future, easy, efficient, profitable. It's an... what? My voice.
Pathetic. I knew you'd say that. What about the smoke? What about the curtsman? What about reality?
No,
you cry for progress. I scream for ice cream.
To the modern army.
Are you going to turn your back on America's fighting men when he come knock, knock, knocking at your front door?
No.
Attaboy. Can't you see it now? As if it were almost tomorrow. Thousands of them.
Shoulder to shoulder.
That's right.
Heart to heart.
You said it, kid.
Satchel to page.
You got it.
Hey, you get it.
Oh, greetings from the President of the United States. Get moving.
Yes, sir.
What's that, boy?
Yeah, sir.
What do you say?
Yeah, sir.
Speak English, troop.
Yes, sir.
You ain't got no friends on the left.
You're right.
You ain't got no friends on the right.
You're left.
Hound dog.
One, two.
Boontang.
Tree frog.
Hound dog. Boontang. Coontown.
That's right.
Hound dog. Boontang.
I'd rather be white than ranch away from the
hound dog. Hound dog. Boontang.
And actual convulsive changes in the political history of Europe. This gave McLuhan his first great insight that would lead him out of the field of literature and into a unified theory of how the world works. And in 1962, he wrote his first book, rather his first really influential book, his second book overall, called The Gutenberg Galaxy. Which really extended the work of Harold Innes into many fields, and gave marvelous examples of how the technology of print, which after all is a technology, the mass distribution of printed material that hasn't been with us all that long, 200 years perhaps, and what this had done to the creation of so many of the or the disruption of many institutions. Now he, in the introduction, and this becomes of real interest in just a second, he describes what he has just done in the Gutenberg Galaxy as, he said, this is a footnote to the great work of Harold Innes. Now there is a scholar not afraid to acknowledge his debts. I mean, there could not have been a more complete or gracious nod to a a mentor than Marshall McLuhan made to Harold Innes. 2 years later, that was a rather esoteric book, as you'll see if you if you've read it or if you do read it. It takes some real close study to follow the Gutenberg galaxy. But in 1964, he published Understanding Media. And now he took the basic insight of Harold Innes, namely that a technological change will produce changes in everything from the way an army runs to the way people think, the way they view themselves, the way they view life, the way they live in a house. He said, after print comes privacy. You didn't need privacy before print. You need privacy to read print. And many other things of that sort. He carried this insight forward into the era of television. And he made this fundamental point that print is a medium that intensifies the visual perception and at the expense of all the other senses. This is his theory. These are things that really cannot be proven one way or another yet. Neuroscience has not reached the point where you can tell whether there is even a balance of senses, such as Marshall McLuhan often described it, much less whether one sense is heightened by a particular medium. But this was the theory.
Sure. Understanding today's complex world of the future is a little like having bees live in your head. But there they are.
Whereas television, he said, returned mankind to a pre-Gutenberg tribal existence in which all of the senses come into play once more, and one is equal to another. And he said, you may think that television is a visual medium. He said, in fact, it's an audio-tactile medium. Now, how can I explain that to you? I can't. No one can. Nobody will know if there's anything to that until a neuroscience, which right now is desperately trying to figure out how the impulse of hunger gets from the stomach to the brain.
I'm marching to dinner, 'cause God Almighty, I'm hungry. Yes, I'm hungry, safe and sound and hungry.
We're hungry!
Of course you're hungry. I'm hungry. We're all hungry, so... let's eat.
Let's eat.
And he said the word, and we ate it. Hot dog. And what was the word?
Hot dog.
Hot dog. Yes, dear friends, a mighty hot dog is our Lord. I'm not talking about hate. No, I'm talking about eight. Dinner at eight. Let's eat.
More sugar.
Ah, the glories of food. The communication of communion. Ethelman Rosenberg, I'm passing along now with the plates. I want you to
must be 4 o'clock in the morning.
Those condiments there. I want you to feel your
I sure
body
am
your
hungry.
Heart, your mind, with the thoughts that he's open. Dear friend, Jesus said, let us be as children.
No cookies,
and what the children do, they stop themselves from day to night. They eat. They fill themselves with their
maraschino cherries, half a jar of mayonnaise. Now that's my last one. Laughing cow cheese, Jesus. It's my mouth dry. I'm so hungry. There's nothing to eat here.
Surrounded by a thin, thin, thin 16-millimeter shell. And inside, it's delicious.
I'll bet.
That's Arnie's whole beef halves we deliver. Thirsty?
That's me.
Wouldn't you like some of this old Filipino creamy coming in shorts and quarts?
Yeah.
And tubs of slaw.
Give me two.
Sorry, only one tub per family. That's whole beef halves we deliver everywhere. Offer not good after curfew in sectors R or M.
They never come into the hills.
Neuroscience is the most exciting field going today, but it has a long way to go. But this was his hypothesis. And Marshall was wonderful at handling critics. He would never pause to debate. He said, these are probes. He said, a pioneer makes probes. He goes into the forest. He doesn't sit there and argue about what this tree looks like that he just put a slash mark in.
Leaping from tree to tree as they float down the mighty rivers of British Columbia, the
redwood, the larch, the fir, the mighty Scots pine, the smell of fresh-cut timber, the crash of mighty trees. With my best girlie by my side, we'd sing, sing, sing. I'm a lumberjack and I'm okay. I sleep all night, I work all day.
He's a lumberjack and he's okay. He sleeps all night and he works all day.
I cut down trees, I eat my lunch, I go to the lavatory. On Wednesdays I go shopping and have buttered scones for tea.
He cuts down trees, he eats his lunch, he goes to the lavatory. On Wednesdays he goes shopping and has buttered scones for tea.
I cut down trees, I skip and jump, I like to press wildflowers. I put on women's clothing and hang around in bars.
He cuts down trees, he skips and jumps, he likes to press wildflowers. He puts on women's clothing and hangs around in bars. He's a lumberjack and he's okay. He sits all night and he works all day.
I cut down trees, I wear high heels, suspenders and a bra. I wish I'd been a girlie, just like my dear mama. I cut down trees, wear high heels, suspenders and a bra. I wish I'd been a girlie, just like my dear mama.
Now, the fact that he had moved on to television is what began to bring Marshall McLuhan such tremendous attention. For example, he said that the generation gap, now we're in the 60s now, and there was a lot of talk about the generation gap because what was happening in music, what is happening with regard to fighting wars in Vietnam, for example, and all sorts of things, there was a generation gap. He said the generation gap is neurological, it's not ideological. Said, these, you're looking at a generation of children who have been raised on television. You know, television did not come in as a widespread medium until probably the mid-50s in this hemisphere. So this was a new, this was a new thing. And he had a lot of empirical evidence on which to base the attitudes of young people. In 1939, out at the University of California, no, in the University, UCLA, I guess it was, he had met a ravishing young actress, Corinne, who became his wife. It was literally a whirl, a, well, not literally, it was a whirlwind marriage in which she had to telegraph from a ship to her parents the fact that she was now Mrs. Marshall McLuhan. He was heading back to Cambridge. They had six children, two sons and four daughters. And he used to marvel at the fact that they could play records, talk on the telephone, watch television, and and listen to the radio, and at the same time do their homework. He came to the conclusion that this is a new century bounce. This has not been seen before. While he went out to the yard to write on a ping pong table. I think he felt very much that he was in the thick of the neurological change that was going on. He felt that there was literally a new human nature.
Let's see. Ideal. Ocelots. Poppers. Pike nipples. Palumbras. Pizzas. Armenian Gardens. Thanks, Juggernaut. Leviathan. Nick Swell.
This is George Tirebiter, Camden N 200R. I want to order pizza to go and no anchovies. What? Man, nobody will come here at all.
Arius, Dr. General. Oh, not Arius. It's a matter of personal taste.
Adam 13's incipient negritude will come as a pleasant surprise to his honorary aquarium parents, Ralph Bunch and Ida Lupino.
Yeah, I'll bet it will.
In other news, final steps was taken in or near Washington to secure the merger of the U.S. government with TMZ General Corp.
Enough.
Neurologically, a new human nature was being created, particularly by television, which had become so ubiquitous in the lives of all. A kind of thing you can't get away from even if you refuse to watch it. You don't have to walk through a gym or through an airport, and you're going to see the plane itself. You're going to see television.
The good book says the TV set is my shepherd.
Yes, mistress.
My spiritual growth shall want. It maketh me to sit down and do nothing for his name's sake, because it requireth all my spare time.
Oh, God, yes.
It keepeth me from my duty as a Christian, because it presenteth so many good shows that I must see. It restoreth my knowledge of the things of the world, and keepeth me from the study of God's word. It leadeth me in the paths of failing to attend the evening worship services, and doing nothing for the kingdom of God.
Nobody's here tonight, brother.
Yea, though I live to be 100, I shall keep on viewing my TV as long as it will work.
Yes?
For it is my closest companion. Its sound and its pictures. They comfort me, friends, they do comfort me.
Like a second heart, Pastor.
It presenteth entertainment before me and keepeth me from doing important things with my family.
Yes.
It fills my head with ideas which differ from those set forth in the Word of God. Surely, no good thing will come of my life.
Aye, surely.
Because my TV offereth me no time to do the will of God.
No, mistress.
Thus,
what time is it?
I will dwell in the place of the devil and his angels forever.
He felt that this new generation would not be able to put up with print-bound teachers who were all raised under the old technology of print. He felt that after this particular generation, nationalism was going to become more and more impossible, because the tendency of television, in combination particularly with the telephone and even the telegraph, which was still used for something besides besides wiring money to people in those days, was creating what he called the global village. He said there was an electronic network was being spread out through the entire earth, and this was creating a kind of universal nervous system that would make nationalism an impossibility and something that would be quite irrelevant. And he said, he said it would be no longer would be possible to artificially, as we now do, he said, separate the races. Things like that will no longer be able to go on. He said, but do not assume that the global village will be friendly. He says, because in villages is where the most cruel people in the world come up. He said, no one knows how to be as excruciatingly brutal as villages. And we only have to read the newspapers today to see he was probably right about that. Nevertheless, he said, it also presented hope.
It takes a village to raise the dead. I'm Lord Eddie Beaverbrook, owner and chief insomniac at
Unconscious Village.
And it's the last day of our last day sale. So read 'em the gospel, Slick.
Thanks, boss. Say, put yourself down under this. It's a horn dog of Babylon, struggle snuff, smother set, and sulfur slack claw.
You'd prophesy the price at $1,000, but read my forehead. 666-66.
Rise now, for I come to your bedroom with my long rod to measure you for the last bed you'll ever need.
Okay, Loach, we got them all. You tell them, little Eddie.
I said it, Dad. Up to my gonads in Rapture Softs, Christian Slaters, Lamb of Gods, Downey Juniors, and Seven Sealies
at Unconscious Village.
I am asleep.
You are.
Look at the time that Innes lives through, the horror of World War I, which he personally experiences, the Depression, World War II, another horror, the Holocaust, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, then the emergence of the Cold War, which Innes is very conscious about and very alarmed about. Well, these are absolutely dreadful times in which Western civilization does literally seem to be falling apart.
I need a tip.
First one's free.
What's the spread on midnight?
Well, the desert says 3-1 on the end of the world, but for my money, you'll be mowing the lawn and popping brewskis per usual tomorrow morning.
No, I bet my farm on Armageddon.
Oh, well, if you can't stand the heat, don't bet the kitchen.
And Innes was amongst that handful who noticed and who tried to rise to the occasion and felt driven to go back to the beginning of history to try and uncover what the hell was going on here.
Harold Innes made his name as an economic historian, interested in the way that various commodity trades had influenced Canada's culture and institutions.
And what do you think they took?
Oil from Canada, gold from Mexico, geese from the neighbor's backyard, boom, boom. Corn from the Indians, tobacco from the Indians, Dakota from the Indians, New Jersey from the Indians, New Hampshire from the Indians, New England from the Indians, New Delhi from the Indians.
Indonesia for the Indonesians!
Yes, Veterans Day.
Then, around 1940, he turned his attention to a new field of inquiry, communications. The depression of the 30s, followed by a Second World War, had convinced him that Western civilization was quite literally collapsing. In fact, when McMaster, his old university, gave him an honorary degree in 1945, he told the convocation bluntly that civilization had collapsed.
It wasn't JFK who was shot in Dallas, it was Bing Crosby.
The Greys, they're behind the plan to make us marry our toaster.
I'm Foster's Vince Muscle. It's in a jar at the White House with Hillary's car.
The great sea didn't put electricity in my toothpaste.
Sit on the Supreme Court's a woman, and it's not the one you think.
Angels on asteroids are dumb crop circles.
It's not coming to an end, because it never began.
It's 11:05:30. High time for a bright light to pierce the conspiratorial darkness. No, I'm not afraid to talk about it, so don't come up on me. I'm Harold Hiphugger with Night Whispers.
Good evening. I'm here beneath the biggest party of the millennium under the stands at Homeless Stadium. And it's time for Fun Fun Town's most controversial radio broadcast. And my only guest tonight, well, I suppose I'm actually his guest. General Y2K, commander of the
Present.
Last Minute Men. Y2K, that's not your real name, is it, Mildew?
These are the last minutes of the last hours of the last century, Hiphugger. Mm. The countdown for liberty has begun, and before the nameless faces of the New World Order can pull the switch, I'm pulling it.
Well, that's fascinating, General.
I was napping poolside at the Gulf War Swimdrome when the government put a chip in my ass, and I'm not going to take it sitting down. It's high noon, daylight slavery time, and as of now, you take your orders from us. And that means me.
Well, you hold right on that thought, General.
And he thought that the history of communications could tell us why. Each civilization, Innes eventually concluded, suffers from what he called the bias of communication. The idea was that all knowledge is shaped by the medium through which it is conveyed. Civilizations survive only by recognizing and resisting the biases to which this makes them subject. In the case of Western civilization, he believed, mass media were rapidly eroding this resistance. Modern societies, he warned, were exposed to a continuous, systematic, ruthless destruction of the elements of permanence essential to cultural activity.
The radio comes into existence. People get a lot of information immediately, which they are not accustomed to dealing with. They become uncertain. Too much information at once. Uncertainty generates a sense that things are risky and they are risk averse and they stop investing. The radio creates an information environment in which that depression occurs. That's the kind of thing that Innes is talking about. It does come back to economics, and Innes is asking the question, what kind of judgments are you going to get if you get an environment which is controlled by a particular kind of information, which will be determined by the instruments of observation, the instruments of reporting observations that we have.
Why don't you listen, Andy?
Davis, you gonna shut up, or is I gonna kick you out the courtroom? The more you talk, the worse off I is.
Now, Brown, you can occasionally use the expression, I don't remember. Don't make it noticeable, but occasionally say, I don't remember. Uh-huh. Now, don't forget that. Now, what are you going to say?
Now, don't forget that.
No,
no.
What are you doing out there?
You don't remember.
Oh,
can you hear the
right.
show?
Can I hear it?
No, no.
Come outside a minute,
remember.
Minnie.
You don't what do you want? What?
No, no.
This is amazing.
Listen.
Turn
you
off the radio.
Remember.
Come on the porch.
Who is my lawyer?
Turn it off?
Yes,
now,
please.
Brown, just
Minnie.
Say, I
all
don't
right.
remember.
What could be so important that I have to change?
Listen. Yes, it's on everywhere, honey. It's on every wheel in the neighborhood. Isn't it amazing, sweetheart? Everybody's listening to the radio, and they're all hearing the same thing.
When people around here say the radio, they don't mean a cabinet, an electrical phenomenon, or a man in a studio. They refer to a pervading and somewhat godlike presence which has come into their lives and homes.
The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
The essays Harold Innes wrote during the last 10 years of his life convey at times an impression of dizzying and disorienting velocity, the sense of a world reeling from one catastrophe to another, unable to find any stable point of orientation or rest. There is a note now and then of suppressed panic in his austere telegraphic prose, a feeling of acceleration and instability. The mass circulation newspaper, he says, has been responsible for a ruthless shattering of language. He speaks of the cruelty of mechanized communication and says it has led to a systematic destruction of elements of permanence essential to culture. Thought, he claims, has been paralyzed. What Innes thought had happened, in the most general sense, was that the mechanization of communication had allowed an unbalancing of the relations between time and space. Mass media dominated vast spaces, while time, he said, was cut into, quote, precise fragments suited to the needs of the engineer and the accountant. His primary example, and the medium of which he made the most detailed analysis, was the mass circulation newspaper, which emerged at the end of the 19th century. The power and reach of the modern newspaper, in Innes's view, was founded, first of all, on a set of linked technological changes.
50 years ago, a young genius made a classic that could never be retold. Now it must be told again, because evil never dies, but copyrights expire. Bottom Feedler Films presents...
All right, sucker. Deal with it. Hit me with your best virus.
Kane!
Mr. Kane, what is so special about this newspaper?
Special? My newspaper will be so clean, you could press a duck in it.
Oh!
Mr. Birdseed?
Yes, sir?
Go to press.
Okay, boss. Go to press!
Kane, the story of a man who knew how to beat a deadline to death.
All right, big guy. I'm gonna grease you with my Smith & Wesson.
No product placement!
What?
Kane, introducing an exciting cast of new young lookalikes.
So, which one of you pretty boys is Kane?
Kane, starring global action figure Charlie Fat.
The use of pulp and papermaking drastically reduced the cost of newsprint. The speed and capacity of printing presses increased. The telegraph allowed information to be gathered more widely and more quickly, and so on. This led to the creation of national markets and the formation of chains. One of the consequences, in Innes's opinion, was the creation of a climate of opinion in which the First World War became possible. Judith Stamps.
The press had played a very important role in what he felt was keeping people's emotions at a boiling point continuously, so that they were ready to mindlessly follow any impulse toward violence, that it kept people at the level just below violence constantly. And he thought that, interestingly enough, it did so not simply out of some kind of sadistic perverseness, but just out of the logic of its own economy. The fact that the press is a commodity that has to sell itself every single day of the week. And it turns out, when you look at its economy, that one of the ways it can do that best is by sensationalizing.
Man, who would have expected the ride we're all having right now? This is pretty amazing, and, you know, who would have thought that this circus would come to town? But, you know, it may not be good for America, but it's damn good for CBS. That's all I got to say.
Sensationalizing makes it possible for it to sell itself because the bold headline sells. But an unhappy after effect is the bold headline also gets people emotionally wound up in a way that it's possible for them to mindlessly follow state policies that might be ultimately destructive of their lives.
In his analysis of the link between World War I and sensationalism in the press, Innes stressed the content of mass media. He was equally attentive at other times to the form, which he believed, for example, had powerful effect on language. In his writings on empire, Innes had seen vernaculars, or everyday languages, as sources of popular independence and resistance to centralized control. Modern mass media, he argued, had been responsible for a mechanization of the vernacular, or, in other words, a takeover of the means of independent thought. Ideas were for sale ready-made.
Sometimes we own the zeros, and sometimes we own the ones.
Hey, there's a 10 in my soup.
Sometimes we own your shoes, and sometimes we own your souls.
It's like walking on a cloud of fresh pork.
Sometimes we own your mind, but we're always in your thoughts.
It's a pig that looks like a locomotive and tastes like flowers.
What do we own?
Souls?
Minds?
Pork?
Kind of. We're U.S. Plus. We own the idea of the idea of America.
This did a couple of things. One of them was that it discouraged people from conversing with each other about politics or anything else, because it did their conversing for them. It defined things for them and consequently rendered them more passive. And he felt that in order to have a really vibrant culture, you had to have people who were used to discussing things together and who were able to constitute themselves as a public orally. It also encouraged a very rigid notion by using very rigid notions of definition itself. People in the press are always trying to prove who's right and who's wrong, trying to present arguments in order to dominate or to avoid from, you know, avoid being dominated. And that acted as a kind of teaching mechanism for people, but it taught them the wrong things.
And speaking of Trump speaking,
in this way, he's very similar to Putin. He uses language to assert his power over reality. Mm-hmm. What he's saying is, I claim the right to say whatever the hell I please. And what are you going to do about it?
It's hard for me to believe that he has the cunning to be perpetrating this intentionally.
It's instinctual. It's, you know, it's a bully in a playground.
Okay.
You know, it's like, imagine the little kid who says to you, you know, give me my pencil box back. And he says, I don't have your pencil box, but it's right there in your right hand. There's nothing in my right hand. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what he's doing. The point is not so much to take your pencil box. It's to render you completely powerless. Because everything you know how to do, which is to say it's right there, is useless.
And you look foolish, no matter what. You don't come out cool.
And you don't get your box back either.
Meaning the box that Trump grabbed, the one containing a functioning democracy. And also meaning your vagina box.
You did not answer the question.
I did answer your question.
No, you did not. Answer the question of why the president asked the White House press secretary to come out in front of the podium for the first time and utter a falsehood. Why did he do that? It undermines the credibility of the entire White House press office
on day one. Don't be so overly dramatic about it, Chuck. You're saying it's a falsehood, and they're giving Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts to that. But the point remains.
Wait a minute. Alternative facts? Alternative facts, four of the five facts he uttered. The
hey,
one
Chuck,
thing he
why?
Got
hey,
right
Chuck.
Was Zeke Miller. Four of the five facts he uttered were just not true. Look, alternative facts are not facts. They're falsehoods.
It taught them to value the wrong things about communication. It taught them to value worrying about who was wrong and who was right in a conversation, rather than thinking in terms of a collective search for truth, even if you never got there, just a collective continual search for truth. That's not the sort of thing that we get in the everyday press. We get a deep concern for proof, capital P, proof, of rightness and wrongness.
Mechanized communication, Innes said, had enormously increased the difficulty of thought. The problem, obviously, was general. But in Innes's view, it was expressed in its most acutely destructive form in the United States.
Eddie Chrysler Motors, makers of the Avenger! By day, a snappy pickup. In the afternoon, a family convertible.
Beep, 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 beep.
By night, a deadly weapon. The Avenger! These are USA, through your turret bay. Your anti-Chrysler car will hold them off.
The idea of bias in Innes is what Humpty Dumpty and Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass calls a portmanteau, a suitcase from which many meanings can be unpacked. It refers to the physical character of the media in question, but also, as Alison Beale has said, to the skills these media foster, the habits of mind they encourage, and the pattern of ownership and control to which they lend themselves. Bias brings certain concerns vividly before us and shades others out of sight. When Innes speaks of the disaster that may follow a belief in the obvious, or says that each civilization has its own methods of suicide, he is referring to this property of bias, that it may hide from us what we most need to know and make us fatally certain of what we should doubt. Robin Neal is a professor of economics at Curtin University and the author of A New Theory of Value, a study of Innes's economics. This is his sense of what Innes means by bias.
The information environment, which determines what we want, is itself limited by the technique that we use in thinking. Our thoughts are controlled by the information flow and by the structure of information. We think about what we're taught to think about, and it is a very simple proposition. I mean, all real big, most important ideas are very simple. Harley Parker said to McLuhan one time, you know, if you've got a full test tube and you want to put something in, you have to take something out.
Hello, what's this? This solution's turning blue. Not quite the solution I expected. That means the rat should have lived and the captain should have died, of course. Let's see. Norveticus ratus, Norveticus asses mammalia, Rodentiae meridae. Here we are. That's black and brown. Eats electricity.
Jones, the rats have gotten to everything but this half tin of Uncle Sigmund's Peruvian cocoa powder.
Oh, that'll be all right. Did you know, Flotsam, that if rats were the size of English children, they could wipe us out in a week?
Shocking. Oh, I don't want to hear about it. Here's your cocoa.
Oh, thank you,
milk, sugar?
No, I'll take it straight.
I'll just have some tea if you don't mind.
Yeah, they're the most advanced animal weapon of destruction yet created.
Hey, we can pay this month's rent, you know, and have a little leftover for food if you'll just tell me a second story.
What am I, a second story man? If it's adventures you want, make them up yourself. Look, here, in the London Exaggerator, it's full of them. Man coughs up towel in Brussels, Yankee pig nut swindle shocks Parliament, Sultan insulted in Mele Mele, giant green cheese stolen.
Anyway, his theory, because it did concern television, began to attract widespread attention in American business circles, because suddenly television was the most important advertising medium that had ever been invented. And Marshall McLuhan, in understanding media, was in effect telling such people, you don't understand media. You don't have the most primitive understanding of these media, which are changing the lives of your children and the world and the world around you. So pretty soon, companies like IBM and General Electric were inviting Marshall McLuhan from St. Michael's College at the University of Toronto to the United States to address their executives. And he was wonderful in these circumstances. Always this lairdly, in the sense of the Scotch laird figure, who would never descend to small talk, always bringing everything around him into the theory. He told IBM, he said, "You don't seem to understand it. You're not in the business of manufacturing these extraordinary machines. You're in the business of moving information. When is this going to dawn on you?" It now has, and you'll see that the literature of IBM in this area now is all about information. It's not about the machinery. He told General Electric, and I loved this. He told the people at General Electric, he said, "You're not in the business of manufacturing light bulbs. You are in the business of information, of pure information." They looked at him like this, and he said, "What do you think light is?" He said, "Light is information with no message." And this rocked them back on their because he did not unlike the way I just presented, I suppose, he did not present it as for shock value. He would usually tuck his chin down. He looked even more lairdly than ever. He would tuck his chin down and make one of these pronouncements. And it frightened the heads of, for about 2 or 3 years, it frightened the heads of American business profoundly. They didn't know what they were doing. That was the message.
Is communication something made clear?
Well, hey, what is communication?
Music. What does it communicate?
What's clear to me, is that clear to you?
Is music just sounds?
Then what does it communicate?
Is a truck passing by music?
If I can see it, do I have to hear it too?
If I don't hear it, does it still communicate?
If while I see it, I can't hear it, but hear something else, say an egg beater because I'm inside looking out, does the truck communicate or the egg beater? Which communicates?
Which is more musical, a truck passing by a factory or a truck passing by a music school?
Are the people inside the school musical and the ones outside unmusical?
What if the ones inside can't hear very well? Would that change my question?
Do you know what I mean when I say inside the school?
Are sounds just sounds, or are they Beethoven?
People aren't sounds, are they?
Is there such a thing as silence?
Even if I get away from people, do I still have to listen to something?
Say I'm off in the woods. Do I have to listen to a stream babbling?
Is there always something to hear, never any peace and
quiet? If my head is full of harmony, melody, and rhythm, what happens to me when the telephone rings? To my peace and quiet, I mean.
Hello?
Good morning, Mr. Tirebiter. This is your service. Time to wake up.
Oh, that's all right, my dear. I've been up all night watching myself on the TV.
Oh.
I don't suppose there'd be any messages for me this morning.
Just a moment. Yes, sir, there are some. A Mr. Sennett call.
Mr. Sennett?
And a Mr. Keaton, Babe Hardy, Stan Jefferson, Stan, and Mr. Dunkerfield, or Mr. Roach. Am I going too fast?
Mr. Roach? Oh, no, no, I'm remembering them all. This is wonderful. Is there anyone else?
Well, there was Mr. Turpin, and Mr. Fetchett. Oh, and a Mr. He wouldn't leave his name.
Oh, oh.
And Mr. Lloyd.
Just a moment. I have to go get an ice cream cone. Hold on, I'll be right back.
Mr. Tarwater?
So hungry. Goodness, you came up into the hill. Hey, wait for me! Wait for me! Hey, mister, I got a nickel, wait for me!